Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. For decades, the American Medical Association has played a key role in opposing a single-payer healthcare system, most famously President Harry Truman's 1950 universal healthcare bill. But the AMA is changing its stripes, albeit slowly. A younger, more diverse membership is pushing for change. Dr. Clifford Marks is an emergency medicine resident at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. He recently explained in a New Yorker piece the AMA history with single-payer health. Dr. Clifford Marks, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you so much for having me in.
In 2019, the American Medical Association almost voted to end its opposition to single-payer health care, and that surprised a lot of the members that so many of the members were for it. What happened?
So I think there are a couple of factors at play here. First, as you mentioned, the profession has become more diverse and more representative of society as a whole. The profession really was once, you know, particularly if you were looking at the 40s and 50s when they really were the main drivers against Harry Truman's universal healthcare plan. It was really the preserve almost entirely of white men. And civil rights legislation and changes in societal mores mean that it's simply no longer the case. And I should note there are still, of course, problems of representation in medicine, particularly when it comes to Black, Hispanic, and Native American physicians. But the difference between now and 50 years ago is nevertheless quite profound. So that's one explanation, that the profession becomes more representative and political outlook changes. I think the other explanation is that the economic self-interest of physicians has changed in a way that means they no longer benefit quite so much from staunch opposition to single payer. And what I mean by that is that in the 50s, the prototypical American doctor is really a small business owner. You know, you own your own practice. But today, a doctor is more likely to be an employee of a hospital or a practice group. So the overlap with, say, the Chamber of Commerce's political agenda is just not what it used to be. And then second, there are a lot of players in the healthcare space now that really used to be dominated almost entirely by physicians. You have the rise of hospital systems, pharma companies, insurance companies, med tech device companies. Physicians just don't rule the roost in the way that they did 50 years ago. So in that context, the world in which as a physician, you have to spend hours trying to get prior authorizations from insurance companies or deal with productivity requirements from your hospital, suddenly single payer or more government intervention in general doesn't always look quite so bad by comparison. So I think those are the two major factors contributing to greater openness among physicians to a single payer type reform.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we are talking about the potential for a single-payer healthcare system in the United States. My guest is Dr. Clifford Marks. He's an emergency medicine resident at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, and we'll post a piece he recently wrote for The New Yorker on the American Medical Association and its role in the history of defeating efforts to enact single-payer systems or universal healthcare systems of one stripe or another. If you have thoughts about this going forward, later in the hour, we'd love to hear your questions or your comments. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Dr. Marks, just as the AMA maybe is starting to tip the scales in favor of a change in the system, it's also at the same time lost its clout, right?
Yeah, it's I think for in a couple of ways. One is it doesn't represent the percentage of physicians that it once did. There was a time where more than half of American physicians were members of the AMA, and that's just not the case anymore. So it no longer quite speaks for the majority of physicians in a way that it did. And part of that is it's lost some members on the left side of the political spectrum. And it's also lost some members more recently on the right side of the political spectrum, particularly when it decided to endorse the Affordable Care Act about 10 years ago. So it doesn't have the same clout in terms of speaking for physicians, although it's still the largest physician organization. And the other thing is, as I mentioned, there are a lot of other players in the healthcare space now. The American Hospital Association now spends more than the American Medical Association on lobbying. AHIP and pharma, and you know, there are a lot of lobbying organizations that are not physician driven. So there's sort of an irony here that, you know, the very moment that physicians are starting to maybe come around to this sort of reform is the moment where their voice might not be quite so important.
Which isn't, it's ironic, but it's not a coincidence, right?
No, I think part of the openness is that physicians are having to deal with the power and clout of all these other lobbies, and the effect that's having on their day-to-day job as physicians. And like I said before, I think that really does mean that sort of more government intervention is at least in some ways not quite so onerous as it would have seemed to physicians in the 1950s.
The idea of universal health care or a single payer system, something like that, has been discussed for many decades. It's been in actually, I think I referenced it in my intro, as far back as the 50s, probably earlier, I would imagine, around the New Deal and so forth, when they were pulling together something like Social Security and Medicare of some years mm-hmm. later, probably then as well, right?
Yeah, and there was a fight within the Roosevelt administration at the time about whether to include some sort of universal health care insurance. And actually, Franklin Roosevelt at the time tells his aides that, you know, we really can't go up against the medical establishment. And actually, the AMA finds an effective lobbyist in FDR's personal physician at the time. So as a result, even though Social Security is going forward, and even though a universal healthcare plan is studied within the administration, never really makes it to the top of the agenda. They just decide that the political opposition would be too great. They don't want to foreground it.
What was the philosophical conflict back then?
So I think there's the philosophical conflict or objection from the standpoint of physicians was really concern about government intrusion in decision making. They really didn't like the idea of a government body stepping in and saying, you know, what should and should not be done. But I think there's a broader economic conflict here that is probably more relevant, which is that if you give a government control of setting prices, there's concern, and I think valid concern as far as it goes, that's going to basically drive down prices. Particularly in a single payer system, although that's certainly not the only way to get to universal healthcare, you give the government really the ability to set prices. And when you give a single organization the ability to set prices, the prices are going to be lower if the organization that is setting them is the buyer. So I think there was concern among physicians that this was going to substantially reduce their earning potential. And I think that's probably correct. Now, the flip side of that is healthcare is probably more expensive now as a result, because there hasn't been a check on price growth in the way that you've seen in some other OECD countries.
So to wit, 17 countries, give or take, I think it's about 17, have some kind of nationalized healthcare system. Most of those were post-World War II, right?
Yeah, Yeah. And I think it is important to note that not all of those are truly single payer. Some of them are public-private hybrids, but they usually have some sort of price control built into the private side of the system that has done something to restrain price growth. But yeah, most of those date to sort of the immediate post-World War II era.
And has the fears, I'm wondering what influence the experience in those countries has had on the United States and the players in the United States, I suppose the AMA to wit.
Yeah, I mean, the AMA was very concerned about the spread of these sorts of universal healthcare plans, so much so that when the Canadian single payer system sort of starts out in, I think it was Saskatchewan, which is a relatively small province, they actually send economic aid and help support a doctor strike to try to stop it, because they were very concerned about this sort of system having a foothold on the North American continent. That ends up not being effective. The reform outlasts the strike and eventually is nationalized. But that was certainly a concern of the AMA and American doctors in general, that they really did not want this sort of thing to spread to the United States.
Has any other country shifted to, you know, some kind of government managed system, hybrid or whatever, that would compare to what the U.S. would have to do to make a switch to that? Did it have as entrenched of insurance and pharmaceutical influence?
Yeah, that's a good. I mean, it is genuinely hard to make apples to apples comparisons. Mm-hmm. I can't think of an example sort of within, and part of the problem here is that prices have really sort of exploded in the last like 20 years. And the more expensive this gets and the larger slice of GDP it takes, in a way the harder it is to reform, because there are so many people who have a stake in maintaining the status quo. So it's hard to think of an example that where that's been done, where there's so much economic interest in preserving the status quo as it exists in the United States right now.
I mean, I think back to England in particular, that's what we're most familiar with. And it was World War II that laid bare the deficiencies of healthcare in England. Post-World War II, there were so many sick, undernourished people. There were so many problems. I'm wondering the Affordable Care Act. I'm wondering about the pandemic, and if that has had a similar influence on American attitudes toward it at this point.
Yeah, it's hard to say for sure. I haven't seen sort of convincing polling on that. I think there's certainly a logic to that, but I think it's also worth knowing that what England went through is probably like in terms of kind of societal disruption is probably like of a much greater magnitude.
Yes,
and there was a real sense of like shared sacrifice in a way. Like a lot of times when social reform legislation or social insurance programs are presented, particularly in the American context. And unfortunately, a lot of this has to do with our long history of racism, is there will end up being a pushback that is somehow centered around this idea of, well, some undeserving people will get access to this, and that is a bad thing. And I think there was sort of a unique period in the UK after World War II where there really was a sense of broad shared sacrifice. And I think that argument really didn't have much traction then in sort of the immediate post-World War II era. And I think there was a sense that, you know, this had kind of been earned by everyone in the UK. And I don't, I, you know, it would be nice in a way if there was that sort of sense in the United States, but I don't know that I see that being the case.
Actually, nothing's driven this, you know, it's one of the most divisive issues ever. And then, you know, back in the day when the UK was going to a national system, one of the big threats was that it would lose its doctors, they would go elsewhere, and that people wouldn't want to become doctors. Do we have is there any evidence that that came to pass?
I don't think there is. It is worth, it's the comparison's difficult in part because healthcare is so different now than it was in the late 40s when this plan really, you know, begins to go into effect. And, you know, to be fair, like US doctors make more on a per capita basis than they do in other countries. And, you know, people come and train here from other countries, and there's a reason for that. There's not zero risk. But I think you do have to balance that against the sort of benefits of being able to get more people the coverage they need. The calculus isn't necessarily easy or cut and dry, but you know, there are plenty of very good doctors in the UK. I don't think if you were to talk to British citizens that they would say that was the real problem with their healthcare system, is that their doctors aren't good.
Dr. Clifford Marks, I really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Clifford Marks is an emergency medicine resident at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, and we will post a link to his article in the New Yorker about the experience, the history of the American Medical Association with single-payer health prospects. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A 2020 survey conducted by the Pew Research Center suggested an increasing number of Americans favor a single-payer system for health care. We're talking about what that might look like and whether it's even possible, the pros and the cons. Dr. Jonathan Ross is an associate clinical professor of medicine at the University of Toledo and past president of Physicians for a National Health Program. Dr. Jonathan Ross, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you.
And Robert Moffat is senior fellow in domestic policy studies for the Heritage Foundation, where he advocates for, among other things, limited government intervention in the healthcare market. Robert Moffat, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you very much, Anne. Happy to be here.
Thank you. Robert Moffat, you want to eliminate barriers to personal choice in healthcare options and give Americans more direct control over their healthcare dollars. And I'm wondering, so I guess you don't necessarily like the system the way it's set up now either.
No, I'm not a defender of the status quo.
Okay.
I'm very, very sane, Anne. I recognize reality when I see it, and that healthcare costs too much. It's too bureaucratic. The doctor-patient relationship has been attenuated. And frankly, the markets have been concentrated to the point where Americans are being denied choices that they would otherwise have in a much more liberal system, liberal in the classical sense of the word.
So it's not a binary choice then. It's not an either we go to some kind of nationalized single payer universal health care or we're stuck with what we have now.
It never was a binary choice, as far as I can think. Maybe Dr. Ross would disagree, but no, it's not a binary choice.
So, Dr. Ross, what about personal choice? Is that an accommodation that is not possible with single payer?
Oh, au contraire. Exactly the opposite. What people want is a choice of their doctor and hospital. They are not particularly concerned about what choice of insurance they have as long as it covers the bills. So if you look at a single payer national health insurance program, like an improved expanded Medicare for all, it would cover everybody and offer pretty much complete choice of doctor and hospital, much the way traditional Medicare does now. You know, the tendency has been to, at least in America, to look for market forces as a way of actually controlling healthcare costs. And we've tried just about everything, HMOs, ACOs, PPOs, even SpaghettiOs. I mean, it's crazy the number of different things that we tried, bundled payments, pay for performance, you know, on and on it goes. And yet we're still twice as expensive as all the other countries that have decided that this should be something that they offer to every citizen in the wealthy democracies.
I guess the rub is twice as expensive and not necessarily twice as good.
Absolutely not. It depends. Yeah, there are variable things that we do better. There is, I think, a good argument to say that our cancer care might be better than some of the rich European democracies and other rich democracies around the world. But that's about it in terms of all the other measures of our healthcare system performance, infant mortality, life expectancy, maternal mortality, the number of treatable illnesses that go untreated and result in unnecessary deaths. Those are good measures of kind of the effectiveness of our healthcare system. We're rock bottom compared to those other rich democracies.
Bob Moffitt, the 2020 Pew Research study shows there's an increase in people saying that they may support a single national program. What is it about it that you oppose particularly in this day and age?
Well, it's not what I oppose. It's what many of the people who actually respond to these polls oppose. There's been a lot of surveys done, especially over the past 10 years, mm-hmm. on single-payer healthcare, as you know, Anne, and Dr. Ross knows this too. If you ask people, are you in favor of a single-payer healthcare system, or you're in favor of Medicare for all? Are you in favor of a program where everybody can get care that they want at any time that they want without paying, you know, co-premiums or co-payments or co-insurance. So everybody says, yeah, that's great. Good care at the point of service. Who could possibly be against it? But you also got to remember, and this is a very, very key point, in every time you talk about single payer or any other healthcare proposal, you also have to address the big issue is what is the trade-off? And what has happened with single payer is you'll get these great big numbers, 50, 60, 70%, of people saying, yeah, I want a single payer system, just like in California in 2019. Everybody in California, according to the survey showed most Californians wanted the California healthcare plan, mm-hmm. except if it would raise their taxes. And then in 2020, you had this really comprehensive evaluation of public opinion by the Kaiser Family Research Foundation. And the Kaiser Family Foundation found out that, yeah, people like single payer. They love it, but about 70% of them would oppose it if there were any kind of denial or delay of care, even for some medical procedures. And when it came to taxes, 60% of those people asked again, do they support a single payer? 60% oppose it when they realize that they're going to have to be paying more in taxes than they do today. And so all of these healthcare proposals, no matter what they are, come with trade-offs. And the biggest trade-off in single payer is you're going to be paying very, very high taxes. And at the same time, you are going to be limited to what the government gives you. And that will require the government to make decisions about who gets care, when they get care, how they get care, and under what circumstances they get care.
But aren't we already limited? I mean,
no free lunch.
So the taxes thing, doesn't that, I mean, right now, people who have health care and pay for it pay a lot of money for it.
We do.
And it would shift that to a tax system. Tax
right.
system from a private payer. And it would also take out the middleman. And also the denial or delay of some procedures, isn't that what insurance companies are there for now anyways?
Well, they do, and it all depends upon the insurance company. It all depends, for example, on whether you have a health plan with a very, very large, broad network of providers, doctors, hospitals, clinics, and so on. A lot of that does depend on the individual plan. For example, in the Affordable Care Act, you have basically a very, very comprehensive benefits program, but at the same time, you have very narrow networks. So people do not get access under Obamacare, in many cases, to the kind of care that they want or need. Mm-hmm. And many of some of your finest institutions in the country, like the Cleveland Clinic or the MD Anderson Cancer Center, for example, will not participate in Obamacare. So it's really mixed. I don't think you can talk about the American healthcare system because in fact, it's not a system, Anne. It is nothing that is not a system like Britain or Canada.
Right.
It's a large set of very, very complex third-party payment arrangements, both in the public sector and the private sector. And they're governed by different rules, different regulations, different guidelines. But the problem is that you do not, under a single-payer system, necessarily get access to free care. And we know this because of the experience that we have, and we've got a lot of experience with both the British system and the Canadian system, where people cannot get access to the kind of care that they want or need or desire.
Well, okay. So, Dr. Ross, I mean, we all have experiences. We all come to this with our own personal experiences. Mine is not unusual, waiting months to see a specialist with some of the best healthcare insurance you can get at Ohio State University. Dr. Ross?
Absolutely. I mean, the fact is that I don't know if we'll shift to it, but just recently the Congressional Budget Office actually did an analysis of single payer. And what they say is we can cover everybody, including non-citizens, resident non-citizens. We can cover everybody, comprehensive benefits, dental, vision. Long-term care is a little more sketchy because it would cost an additional chunk, but we can talk about that issue if you want. But you can do that, hold doctors whole using all payer rates, hold hospitals whole using all payer rates, and you save $40 billion in national health expenditures because of the tremendous simplicity eliminates the tremendous complexity. The disease of the American healthcare system is its financial complexity. And you have all 1,000 different insurers, many of whom have multiple plans, different co-payments, different deductibles, have to be tracked all through the system. The doctor's offices and hospitals have to go down those same thousands of rabbit holes to try and collect the money. The growth in the number of people who never look a sick patient in the eyes working in healthcare has been 4,000% in the last 50 years. The increase in the number of doctors and nurses somewhere between 200 and 300%. So we've got this incredible complexity. It isn't even the profiteering that's going on, but there's plenty of that. But it isn't even the profiteering. We actually could save enough money in the administrative simplicity to probably pay them to go away. But it's the complexity. You know, for a while, people were saying it's the prices, stupid, right? And prices in the US are high. But built into those prices is this tremendous complexity. So what we need is universal. Public clearly wants that, even Republicans. We want simple. We want affordable. USA, universal, simple, affordable. Those are the three things. Now, I've been studying health policy since 1980. I've looked at all the international plans, and they're all a little bit different. But we have something that we've already created, already have a law that is universal for people over 65 and for the disabled, and that's Medicare. And we know it works, and people are satisfied with it. We can build on it.
All right. So, Robert Moffitt.
Well, there's a lot to respond to there.
It is.
Our system is complex. The private sector is complex. The public sector is also complex. If you take Medicare and Medicaid, for example, you're talking about very complex systems. Medicare is got Medicare Part A, Medicare Part B, got Medicare Part D, Medicare Part C. And it's governed by tens of thousands of pages of rules and regulations and guidelines that are imposed on doctors, hospitals, clinics, home health agencies, all across the country. There's nothing, if you talk to any physician, there's nothing simple about Medicare. And not only that, a lot of people who are—
Are you a doctor?
Pardon?
Are you a doctor?
No, of course not.
Okay. I've practiced private medicine for 40 years. I'll talk about Medicare in a minute.
All right, very good. But the fact of the matter is that a lot of physicians will complain about the paperwork. And it's not only in the private sector, it's also in Medicare. And the Physicians Foundation, for example, has a survey on that. The truth of the matter is that the idea that you're going to have administrative savings, all of that depends upon the complexity of your healthcare proposal. And as the RAND Corporation pointed out, yes, you can get administrative savings, but it all depends on the complexity of the program. If you look at the Sanders bill, for example, or the House Democratic single-payer bill, they're extremely complex. And the regulatory regime that will come out of this based on the statutory provisions are going to be enormous. So the government will determine in detail what kind of benefits and medical procedures and treatments you will get. And each one of these are going to be accompanied by a regulatory regime determining what is reimbursable and what is not. So you do not escape with a single payer system the complexity of the current system. You basically transfer the authority, you know, basically from private insurance and also from employers to government officials.
But that's you transfer it from private insurance, which is beholden to its shareholders, to government control, which we all know about the stories about government bureaucracy and whatnot, but it's beholden to the people.
Are they really?
Well,
the fact of the matter is, you know, basically what you're talking about is turning the system over to Congress. I mean, you're talking about when you talk about a single.
Well, gosh, when you put it that way.
Well, no, but that's what it is. I mean, read the bills, read the Senate bill, read the House bill. I think Americans got to ask themselves a very simple question. Do they want the Congress of the United States running healthcare? Because that's basically what it's going to be. Doctors, okay. Hospitals and clinics are not going to be independent. They're going to be subjected to statutory changes. And if you follow the Medicare debate, as I do every year, basically Washington becomes an arena of a feeding frenzy among special interests, trying to basically manipulate the system to increase their reimbursements at the expense of others. This is not a simple program. And this is not something that necessarily puts the patient first. In fact,
I want to talk about traditional Medicare here. May I, as a physician who practiced medicine, talk about traditional Medicare?
Okay.
I never had problems dealing with the oversight from traditional Medicare. I practiced very good medicine. I was an academic, you know, I was a teacher. And I never had trouble with Medicare. Who did I have trouble with? All of the private insurers and the barriers that I saw with that. And who did my patients have trouble with? Not with traditional Medicare. They had trouble with the private sector, you know, with all their, you know, rules and regulations and networks and everything else. So give me, even if I have to have regulations, give me one set.
Okay.
Right? Not a thousand.
Let's take a break right here. My guest, that is Dr. Jonathan Ross. He's an associate clinical professor of medicine at the University of Toledo and past president of Physicians for a National Health Program. And also with us, Robert Moffat. He's a senior fellow in domestic policy studies at the Heritage Foundation. We're talking about the pros and cons of some kind of universal, some kind of nationalized, some kind of single payer. Depends on, you know, there's a lot of different stripes, but when it comes to healthcare, but that's what we're talking about today. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. We're looking at the prospects of changing how we pay for healthcare in the U.S. And the role of government in all of that. Our guests are Dr. Jonathan Ross. He's an associate clinical professor of medicine at the University of Toledo and past president of Physicians for a National Health Program, and Robert Moffat, senior fellow in domestic policy studies for the Heritage Foundation. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org if you have a question or comment. Bob Moffitt, navigating healthcare systems is complicated and confusing. We've already, I think we've kind of pretty much settled that issue, but you advocate for Americans to have more control over their healthcare options. How do you do that within the existing system?
Within the existing system? Well, it's going to be a very heavy lift.
Okay.
It's going to be a very heavy lift because actually we have a situation right now in the United States where healthcare is about almost 20% and almost about 20% of our economy, $4.1 trillion. And as I said earlier, it's basically a system of third-party payment. But none of the key decisions in the system, what kind of health plan you get, what kind of benefits you get, what kind of medical treatments and procedures are available to you, you know, even what you will pay in premiums, deductibles, co-payments, co-insurance. Basically, it's a system right now, both in the public sector and the private sector, where individuals have very, very little economic power. These decisions are made by corporate benefit managers. They're made by members of Congress. Today, especially with the Affordable Care Act, state legislative leaders and employers basically make these decisions. The only way, it seems to me, that we can actually get to where I want to go, which is quite different from where Dr. Ross wants to go, is to basically enable individuals, empower individuals to basically pick and choose the health care plan that they think is best for them and enable them to do that without a tax or a regulatory penalty. Today, if I get health insurance through the place of work, and I do, and it's a very, very good health plan, no question about it, I don't suffer, you know, because I'm in a large, basically a large company-based plan. You know, I've got a very, very large benefits package. It's very, very attractive. I get 100% tax relief for the purchase of health insurance if I get it through my employer. However, if I lose my job or I change my job or I go from one job to another, I don't lose my life insurance, my auto insurance, my homeowner's insurance. I only lose my health insurance because, unlike all other types of insurance, it doesn't belong to me. So there's no portability in the coverage. And basically, there's no real control about, you know, there's no real control over this. So what I would suggest is that what we move toward is a defined contribution system for Americans, where basically they get individual tax relief for the purchase of insurance, regardless of where they get it. If they get it at the place of work, fine. If they get it outside of the place of work, if they get it from a trade association or an ethnic or fraternal or religious institution, if they want, they would get tax relief on an individual basis to offset the cost of that plan. But at the same time, they would own that plan just like they own their life insurance, auto insurance, homeowner insurance, and take it with them from job to job without a tax or regulatory penalty and through different stages in life. We do this in other areas, but the healthcare system is so radically different because here in the healthcare system in the United States, the individual basically has very little control over anything. I mean, there's only a very, very few number of people who actually have the kind of freedom to pick and choose what they want. I was lucky to some extent within the insurance market because I worked for the federal government for 11 years and I was in the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program, which is a defined contribution system for federal workers and retirees. And frankly, it's the best insurance that I ever had. I could pick and choose the plan that I wanted. And I was in a union plan and I was also in Blue Cross Blue Shield for a while, but if you don't like it, you basically can fire the insurance company, which is what Americans need to do.
Okay.
That way we'll get competition and choice and we'll improve the quality of care and improve access as well.
Jonathan Ross?
Yeah.
What about that? Yeah.
Okay. So which types of insurance plans have the highest overheads, right? It's ones that are individual, like per family or per person. Those are 20%, sometimes even higher. There was one called Golden Rule. I'll call them out on this one. This is years ago. It's probably different now because Obamacare said that you had to spend at least 80% of the money on actually giving people health care. But this plan spent 50%. That's all. Half the money went to overhead and to their profits, and they sold their plans individually. Now, servicing, it won't be $300 million because probably we'll do this by family. I assume, Bob, that's what you mean, it'd be family programs. But $300 million individual insurance programs for 300 million people trying to keep track of that as a doctor? Oh, my God. You know, do they have a $10 copayment, a $50 copayment? Do they have so I'm going to have to take every one of those people and figure out what their benefits cover and what they don't. And again, in my experience with co-payments, you know, trying to collect co-payments as a physician, it costs me, doesn't matter if it's a $5 co-payment or a $50 co-payment or a $100 co-payment, it's the same amount of work. It's the same amount of overhead. Mm. So in co-payments, at least the research suggests, kill people, especially sick people and disabled people.
You know, poor people.
They don't come to the doctor when they need to.
Right.
And so there's no evidence that co-payments are help. Now, and if co-payments or deductibles actually work to control healthcare costs, we would have the lowest costs in the world because we have the highest out-of-pocket costs of all these rich nations. So it ain't working. It's like the first rule of holes. If you're in a hole, stop digging. We've tried all these things in terms of market forces, none of which have worked, including co-payments, high co-payments and deductibles. And so I think it's kind of preposterous to think that we'll actually have less overhead if we have 300 million different health insurance policies, or even say 150 million different health insurance policies for the doctors to deal with. I just don't see it. I think it's okay. Going to still be an administrative nightmare.
I want to take a call from Mark. Mark, okay. You're on the air in Columbus.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yeah, my comment would be, instead of argue back and forth, one payer system, free market system, or whatever, we have the absolute best example of socialized medicine in the United States of America, and that's called the Veterans Administration. Since 1914, we've been taking care of millions of veterans. The main theme of the Veterans Administration is you will wait. I've been cared for by the Veterans Administration for a couple years in years past. My brother is currently under care, and we have both waited sometimes weeks, sometimes months to get a X-ray or get a lab test or to even see a doctor. And so what we should do is run a program on the Veterans Administration, have veterans call in and tell everyone their story. And there you have a very good example of how nationalized medicine would look like, because all they'll simply do is expand the Veterans Administration.
Okay.
And we'll have all those problems to deal with.
Let's see. Okay. So...
That's not what Medicare for All will be, as I'm sure you know, Anne.
Right. It's a very different system.
All the doctors, open access to every doctor in hospital. We're not talking about a very limited system of buildings with a limited number of doctors who are on salary. That's not what we're talking about.
Yeah. Bob Moffitt?
Well, I would disagree. I think the caller had it exactly right. We had a scandal, actually, a few years ago under the Obama administration where you had the bureaucratic manipulation of waiting lists that's denied access to care for budgetary reasons in many cases, which resulted in the death and further disability of many, many, many veterans. The Government Accountability Office did a study on it, and a number of others. It was actually one of the biggest scandals of the last 10 years was the performance of the veterans program.
Well, I've never heard anybody put the Veterans Administration out as a prime example of what to do.
Oh, I have.
Yeah.
Washington, D.C., I have.
But I'm not. Nor are the...
All right, we can disagree.
Yeah.
We're not talking about the VA.
But the fact of the matter is, it is a single-payer system. And what the caller has talked about is not, you know, something that is, not an exception to the rule. If you look at the British system, going back to 2011, the British system had 2.6 million people on their waiting list. By 2017, it was over 4 million. By 2019, it was 4.4 million. Today, it's 5.8 million.
Talk about waiting lists.
And single payer system, pure example. The British health secretary now says that the waiting list in Britain could go up into double digits. Canada, according to the Commonwealth Fund, which is not, you know, is one of the real liberal think tanks, describes the Canadian waiting list as some of the worst in the developed world. So this is not something that you can escape. Hmm. If you say that healthcare is going to be a free good, you have an unlimited demand for a free good. Economists know that. And when you have an unlimited demand for a free good, that's going to crash up against limited supply. And somebody is going to have to make decisions.
Well, Bob, I mean, the point taken, the supply and demand thing and what the supply costs, all that point is taken. But like I said earlier, I have had to wait months to see a specialist. There is already a supply problem out there, isn't there, Bob?
There is. But I mean, the thing is that if you want to make comparisons, let's make comparisons. The Journal of the American Medical Association in 2018 did a comprehensive study of waiting times. They found that 39% of patients in Canada had to wait more than 2 months to see a medical specialist compared to 6% of patients in the United States. We're not perfect, but we are responsive.
They left about 30 million people there, Bob.
I understand.
We don't know how long the uninsured wait.
Well,
we don't have any data on that. We've got as many people as live in Canada almost who have nothing at all. We have no idea what their waiting times are.
Yeah, well,
so don't tell me that the waiting times are comparable because you're not bringing in the uninsured for waiting times.
I'm wondering about the middleman in all of this. Bob Moffitt, you've suggested that it just will shift to more control by the government over everything. Right now, you know, when we talk about healthcare being 20% of our economy, that's not doctors and nurses and technicians that are taking care of me. A lot of that has to do with the private sector technology and, most importantly, the insurance sector, right?
The insurance sector, plays a role. There's no question about it. Most of your healthcare spending, actually, in the United States, about 75% of your healthcare spending goes to treatment of people with chronic conditions. A lot of them in hospitals. Hospital costs have been exploding in many years. And we do spend a lot on healthcare. We spend an awful lot on medical technology and medical science. We're the leaders of the world when it comes to breakthrough technologies and therapeutics and pharmaceuticals. Increases in diagnostic technology, more sophisticated diagnostic technology, is a feature of the current system, as inefficient as a lot of these markets are. So Americans do pretty well, as Dr. Ross pointed out. We do great on cancer care. We actually do very well when it comes to cardiac care. And when it comes to the treatment of people from stroke, we're world-class beaters compared to some of our neighbors in highly industrialized Western countries.
So, Dr. Ross, we're just about out of time. I want to, get your thoughts on that, the fact that, I guess it's the nothing's perfect piece of it, so why change?
Why change? We have 30 million people who can't get in line. That's why. And we've got another 100 million if you add those 30 million to the people who are afraid to go to the doctor because healthcare costs could bankrupt them. And, so what we're doing is we're torturing our friends and neighbors who are sick. And people, healthcare is not a normal product. You don't go to the doctor for fun, right? If open heart surgery was on sale, you wouldn't have two, right? This is the whole notion that this is an ordinary product that market forces can control is preposterous. Somebody comes to me with chest pain. I don't know if I'm going to spend $5 on Maalox or $150,000 on open heart surgery until I do some really expensive tests. So there's just this whole idea of price transparency that you can somehow make the market work. We've been trying the market for 50 years now, and all it's done is double our costs and 4,000% growth in administrators. We need simple. We need universal, we need simple, we need affordable. My studies over my lifetime in healthcare and actually practicing in that environment, there's one way we can do it that would be straightforward and people understand: an improved, expanded, traditional Medicare for all.
Dr. Jonathan Ross, I want to thank you for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Jonathan Ross, Associate Clinical Professor of Medicine at the University of Toledo. He's past president of Physicians for a National Health Program. And Robert Moffitt, thanks to you as well. I really appreciate your time today.
I appreciate the opportunity, Anne. Thank you very much.
You bet. Robert Moffitt is a senior fellow in domestic policy studies at the Heritage Foundation. That's it for now. This topic will not go away, though. We all know that. So stand by for more conversation. But for now, thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.